to do today. Lots of work. So, no proverb today. We got too much work to do. I know. It's a week of no proverbs. In 2 weeks, you're not going to get any proverbs. Ever again. Because we're done. Ever. Not from me. Not from up here. You got to read them on your own. You big babies. Get off the bottle.
We're never allowed to be talking about anybody else, right?
Yeah, that's right. Just if anyone tries, you say, mm-mm.
What about daily devotions that we can't teach ourselves?
Only if it's like old dudes like Spurgeon or... Yeah, so obviously yesterday I fell far short of the intended goal, so we have quite a bit of work to do today. So here's what we're going to do. I'm going to try to, as I tried to do yesterday, skip some rocks, which didn't happen. There are just too many good stories in here, so I scheduled 2 days to teach 2 Kings and I need 4. So we'll deal with what we got. So on that note, let me pray. We'll pick up in chapter 9 of 2 Kings with Jehu, interesting king, and see if we can finish 2 Kings today, Lord willing. God, thanks for this day, for this time. Lord, as we continue to move into the spring and summer, and God, I know schedules are just crazy right now with work and school and life, and it just seems like everything kind of ramps up right now because things are finishing, so I just pray for perseverance, God, in the midst of all of our journeys as we're trying to just finish a season well. So as you teach us, God, this morning from the Kings, Father, pray that we would learn, that we would glean, that we would see the lessons that are here. We're grateful for this time. In Christ's name, amen. Amen. All right, so we left off yesterday. We got 2 kings in the same location. We are about to see the assassination of both of them by another king. So if you look on your chart, on the right-hand side about midway down, you see a guy named Jehu, J-E-H-U. He is coming in to wreck shop. The guy above him is Jehoram. He is the current king, and he's going to visit Amaziah, the king on the left. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 kings down. Okay? Sorry, 6 kings down. Ahaziah. Okay? God is going to anoint this guy to come in and basically do a work on these kings because of the evil that's happening in the land. So 2 Kings 9, we'll start there. And again, I'm going to summarize a lot of these stories. 9, 1 through 10, we get the anointing of this king, Jehu. Okay, verse 2, he's mentioned as the son of Jehoshaphat, the son of Nimshi. This is not King Jehoshaphat. It's a different Jehoshaphat. And he's not a king. He is, in verse 5, named a captain. So he's a military guy that God's going to use to end the reigns of these two pagan kings. And he's one of the few kings, arguably, in the north that you almost want to paint him a little bit blue. But you just can't because he finishes bad. Okay? He's told in verses 1 and following by Elisha. Elisha sends one of his boys, the sons of the prophets, to go anoint this guy king. And it's fascinating what he tells him. He says in verse 3, "Take the flask of oil, pour it on his head, and say, 'Thus says the Lord, I have anointed you king over Israel.' Then open the door and flee. Do not wait." So, I've just given you all the power. Now I'm going to leave. So, it's an odd deal. So, you kind of get a feel for kind of Jehu's personality. So it's like you just handed this guy a grenade and you pulled the pin, and Elisha says, don't stick around to see what happens. It's going to be gnarly. So, and indeed it will. So, verse 6, he's told, I'm going to anoint you king over the people. Verse 7, you're going to strike the house of Ahab. So that's the kings in the north. The whole house of Ahab in verse 8 shall perish. Every male is going to die because of Ahab's sin. I'm going to make it like the house of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, the house of Baasha, who came in and wrecked shop in Jeroboam's life, in verse 9. And in verse 10, we see the prophecy of what's going to happen to Jezebel. This is the evil wife of Ahab she's a Phoenician. It says the
Jezebel
dogs...
hasn't died yet.
Not yet. Okay. Not yet. She's still queen mother.
I remember we were talking about that story with her husband.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Ahab. He's still very much dead. She is still very much alive.
Whatever happened.
Uh-huh. We're about to find out. She's got a nasty death. The dogs shall eat Jezebel in the territory of Jezreel. So that's how she's going to die. And it's all going to come underneath Jehu. Okay, so this is what this guy's known for. He's going to kill two kings, all of Ahab's 70 sons, and Jezebel. And then he's going to start worshiping Baal. So he's got a great story. You're going to all want to like him, and then you won't. So anyway, this is the story of Jehu's coming. So this is the prophecy that he's given. They anoint him king, 11 and following. He's kind of exalted, and they're not sure whether to follow him or not because he's not the current king, but yet God told him he's going to be. So he now comes to visit these two kings that are, one is recovering and one is seeing and visiting this recovering king, and they see Jehu coming, and they know enough about his personality to realize, why is he coming? So they send a delegation, verse 18, a horseman went to meet him, and he says to Jehu, like to meet him halfway before he comes and meets the kings, is it peace? I'm in 9:18. And he says, what have you to do with peace? Turn behind me, meaning, no, I'm not coming for peace. Go away. They send a second horseman, and finally a third. And basically, Jehu says every time, I'm not coming for peace. I've come to wreck shop. Have you ever heard that, the saying, it's an old one, that he drives like a Yehu. It's an old like New York taxi cab driver saying. It comes from this guy. Yahoo. It's actually Yehu. So Yahoo, but that's where it comes from. Okay. Verse 20, the watchman reported, he came to them and he did not return. And the driving is like the driving of a Yahoo, the son of Nimshi, for he drives furiously. Okay. That's where the quote comes from.
Wait, is that where we get Yahoo? Like Yahoo? Yeah,
I think so. There are no juz in Hebrew. It's all yah. So it's Yeshua, it's Yehu, so a J is a Y, essentially, it's how you pronounce it. So, there you go, okay? So there you go. Things that you can now spank people out of Bible trivia. Congratulations. So, anyway, so he comes in driving furiously. He finds King Joram of Israel and Ahaziah, the king of Judah. These guys are the two kings on the block, and they are in the property of Naboth the Jezreelite. Again, last time we saw Naboth, he was arguing with Ahab, got set up and murdered because Ahab wanted his vineyard. He takes it. They ask him again in verse 22, is this peace? And he says, no, it's not peace. Verse 24, Jehu drew his bow with his full strength and shot Joram between his arms, and the arrow went through his heart and sank into his chariot. So he kills king number one. He's dead on the spot, right? He says in verse 25, take him up, cast him into the property, the field of Naboth, the Jezreelite, for I remember what you and I were writing together after Ahab, his father, what the Lord said regarding this oracle, meaning all this is going to come now to pass because Ahab took his property, and now you, as the successing kings, are going to die in this guy's property. Now he's got his eyes turned on the next king, verse 27, Ahaziah, the king of Judah, saw this, Jehu pursued him and shot him too in his chariot, so now we have two dead kings. So there's no king in Israel, there's no king in Judah. Jehu is the next king. Then in verse 30, he's got his eyes set on Jezebel. She hears about it, and it says in verse 30, she painted her eyes and adorned her head and looked out the window. So she's up in this palace, and she puts on her, basically her burial makeup, because she knows what's coming. And she says in verse 31, is it well, Zimri, your master's murder? She's basically saying, it's sarcasm. Zimri, who about 45 years before, I have a note here, killed one of the other kings, Baasha, and then killed himself a week later. So she knows death is coming. The murderer is on the doorstep. So she calls him Zimri to say, I know what you're about to do. I've heard that you've just killed two kings, and now you're coming for me. He lifted up his face to the window and said, who is on my side? So he's now looking up at her in the palace, and he speaks to the guards that are around Jezebel and says, who's on my team? Two or three of the officials look down at him, basically saying, we're in, and this is how she dies. He simply just speaks to these officials and says, throw her down. Just huck her off over the palace walls. And sure enough, verse 33, so they threw her down, and some of her blood was sprinkled on the wall. That's a nice word. And on the horses, and he trampled her underfoot. So they throw her off the wall, she dies, and then he runs his chariot over on top of her. When he came in, he ate and drank. Like, he runs her over, leaves her there, and then walks in and makes a sandwich. This is Jehu. Like, he's just killed two kings, now Jezebel, and then as he's eating, he's like, oh yeah, we should probably go do something with her body. Verse 35, they went to bury her, but they found no more of her than the skull and the feet and the palms of her hands. The prophecy was what about her? What was going to happen to her body? The dogs would eat her, and sure enough, they did, and they wouldn't even eat her head because she's filthy, like her mouth and her hands, and so they leave her. So this is an odd chapter. So two dead kings, one filthy mother-in-law, or mother, I should say, queen now dies. She, in verse 36, as it said, dies in the property of Jezreel, and the dogs shall eat the flesh of Jezebel, and sure enough, they did. So now Jehu's going to turn his attention to Ahab's line, the 70 kings that would come from him potentially, and basically annihilate his entire line. And sure enough, that's exactly what he does. He sends in verse 3, he says, select the fittest, the best and fittest of your master's son, and set them on the master's throne. He writes letters to these people saying, give me your kids, who wants to be king next, because I'm going to kill them, basically. And the people who receive the letter say, listen, we're your servants, in verse 5, all that you say to us, we will do. We will not make any man king. Do what is good in your sight. They realize it's a ploy by Jehu to basically start murdering kings. And they said, man, what do you really want? And he says, well, here's what I really want. Verse 6, somebody pick up there and read that. 10 verse 6, this is Jehu's request of Ahab's line.
Then he wrote to them a second letter, saying, if you are on my side, and if you are ready to obey me, take the heads of your master's sons and come to me at Jezreel tomorrow at this time. Now the king's son, 70 persons, were with the great men of the city who were bringing them up.
So he's like, just come meet me at the park and bring 70 heads with you. That's what I want. Good Lord, dude. Like, it's just no tact. No, like, just behead them and then bring them in baskets. I want to see them, basically, is what he's asking.
Does Jehu have a reputation prior coming onto the scene?
We don't know. All we know is he's a military man, and when the kings see him, they fear greatly. So, yes, apparently, this is his MO. Like, they just know he is not. He's slaughter first, ask questions later, you know, and eat a sandwich while you're doing it. Like, so I don't care.
So as he starts off his question of, are you on my side, is this more of, do you want to die or follow my instructions?
Yes.
Okay.
Do you like your life? Then you're on my side. If not, I'll kill you too, right? And I don't care. So God's anointed me king, and that's why they were so hesitant to make him king, because I think they understood how he led militarily. He's going to do the exact same thing. So if God says, go annihilate that line, he's like, okay, that's what I do for a living. Great. What do you want me to do for the rest of the day after I get done doing that type thing? So, exactly. So, and sure enough, came about when they took the letters of verse 7 that they took the king's sons, slaughtered them, 70, put their heads in baskets, and sent them to Jezreel. So they're dead. So he has killed now two kings, Jezebel, and then all 70 of Ahab's kids, except for one. There's one kid that survives. We'll read about him next. So he is literally just, God is hitting the reset button in both the north and the south because of the evil that's going on. And Ahab's one surviving son that we're about to see come on the throne is actually a good dude. He starts okay, and we'll see why. He has a very different story. But this is kind of how this ends. Now, to Jehu's credit, he does some pretty cool stuff. He arrests people kind of in the rest of chapter 10, verses 14 and following. Some people that unfortunately don't know what's happened. And he's like, what team are you on? I'm like, oh, we're for Ahaziah, the king that you just murdered. Not knowing that he had murdered them. He's like, oh, you dummies. Like, he kills them as well. Puts them in prison and then kills them in verse 17. So then in 18, not only is he going to kill the kings, he's going to eradicate Baal worship. This is awesome. It's a funny story. He says in verse 18, he gets all the people together, and he says, Ahab served Baal a little. Jehu will serve him much. Ahab didn't worship Baal a little, right? This is the 850 prophets on the hill, right? He worshipped Baal a lot. And Jehu says, if you think that was impressive, we're going to have a Baal worship service that you've never seen before. So he basically sends letters in verse 19 and says, summon all the prophets of Baal, all of his worshipers, and you tell him to come show up on worship night, okay? And he's playing them. Bring everybody in. Verse 21, he sent throughout all of Israel, all the worships of Baal came, and there was not one man left who did not come. So you have every Baal worshiper in the land in one building at the same time, right? And then he basically says, bring them all in, and he tells his servants who are guarding, you know, the doors, if anybody gets out of here, it's your life in exchange for theirs. So you can see kind of what's going to happen. The one who permits any of the men whom I bring into your hands, in verse 24, to escape, shall give up his life in exchange. Nobody leaves. So he gets everybody in the building. They start building an altar. It says in verse 25, they finished offering the burnt offering. Jehu now says to his officials, walk inside and slaughter everybody. And that's exactly what they do. They kill every Baal worshiper in verse 25 with the edge of the sword. The guard and the royal officers threw them out and went to the inner room to the house of Baal. They brought out in verse 26 the sacred pillars, the house of Baal, and burned them. In verse 27, this is a funny verse. They broke down the sacred pillar of Baal, broke down the house of Baal. So every instrument of worship that was used to worship Baal, they bring it outside and they destroy it. And in verse 27, end of verse 27, it says, and they made it a latrine to this day. It's a beautiful commentary on idolatry in the eyes of God. So what is idolatry worth in the eyes of God? You make it a big urinal and you just pee on top of it. Like that is idolatry in God's eyes. But 28, Jehu eradicated Baal out of Israel. This was the goal of God, right? Get the pagan kings off the throne that are worshiping Baal, eradicate Baal worship from the land, and he does it. The problem is, verse 29, however, as for the sons of Jeroboam, remember our boy Jeroboam has been off the throne for 200 plus years at this point. He made Israel sin. Jehu did not depart even from the golden calves that were in Bethel and Dan. So now he continues to worship not Baal, but these false gods to begin with. And God says to him in verse 30, because you have done well in executing what is right in my eyes and have done to the house of Ahab according to all that was in my heart, your sons to the fourth generation shall sit on the throne of Israel. So I'm going to give you a line for four more generations because you eradicated evil from this line. The problem is verse 31. Stephanie, read that in verse 31. So he does all this stuff, but he continues to worship false gods. So it's a bummer of a story that we see his life in the end, and he does some things for God. He's obviously very zealous, but when it comes to eradicating 100% of the evil in the land, he won't do it, and he's still worshiping the wrong gods in the wrong way. So that's kind of the end of his story. Verse 35, he slept with his fathers, they buried him, and he reigned over Israel, verse 36, for 28 years. So two kings.
That's it.
28 years. So what's fascinating about some of these stories, by the way, is the amount of time these kings reign and how little we know about them. So think about that. That's 28 years. David, Saul, and Solomon are all 40 years apiece. We're going to have a king that we're about to read about this morning that reigns for 52 years, and we get one chapter on them. And there's kings that reign longer than we get less, but this is what they're known for. Okay. So now, chapter 11, verse 1, here's the one surviving son of Ahab. Okay, and it's kind of cool how the story goes down. 11:1, Athaliah, you guys remember Athaliah? She is the daughter of Ahab and Jezebel, who was given in marriage from the north to the south to Jehoshaphat for his son to marry. Okay, she's the queen mother. So she's just as evil as Jezebel, who we saw get murdered. So we have these two evil women that are trying to vie for the throne. She saw that her son was dead. She rose and destroyed all the royal offspring because she wants to be the new king. Okay, she's evil. Verse 2, Jehosheba, the daughter of King Joram, sister of Ahaziah, took Joash, the son of Ahaziah, and stole him from among the king's sons who were being put to death and placed him in the and he and his nurse in the bedroom, and they hid him from Athaliah, and he was not put to death. So we have one king who's protected from this massacre that's going on that Athaliah is leading. and she was hidden, he was hidden, verse 3, for 6 years while Athaliah was reigning over the land. So you see on your chart, you've got what's called the Athaliah Rebellion. So she is king, basically, or queen, I should say, for 6 years, and they hide this son, okay, Joash. And we find out that this guy has a very fascinating life. So he's literally in hiding. They can't bring him out. And then when he's old enough to become king, which is an odd age we're going to see, they bring him out and go, ta-da, and throw a crown on his head. Okay. Verse 4, though, this is why this kid has a really, really good start. Somebody read that, 11:4. Okay, so Jehoiada is the current high priest, and he's basically going to be the surrogate father of this kid. Okay, he's young, and he's going to be—he's going to live underneath the tutelage of this kid. Okay, so he's going to be instructed by a godly priest as his father, and they basically formulate a plan. The kid's going to be 7 years old when he becomes king. And they're going to bring him out in this big, again, ta-da, and display him as king. And they kind of go through the rest of this chapter displaying how they're going to do that. Verse 12, then he brought the king's son out, put the crown on him, gave him the testimony, and made him king and anointed him. And they clapped their hands and said, long live the king. So Athaliah has no idea that for 7 years they've been hiding this kid. Athaliah heard of this in verse 13. Says, man, this is treason. At the end of verse 14, tore her clothes. Verse 15, they say, let her not be put to death in the house of the Lord. So they capture her and then bring her out. Verse 16, they seized her. When she arrived at the horse's entrance of the king's house, she was put to death there. So they murder now or kill Athaliah for this rebellion. And this new king, Joash, is put on the throne. Again, verse 17, Jehoiada made a covenant between the Lord and the king of the people that they would be the Lord's people. He starts well. Verse 18, this young 7-year-old king. That's insane, right? I mean, I have an 11-year-old kid. I can't fathom having a 7-year-old. This is what, a second grader? First or second grader, yeah, being king in the land, right? Insanity. All the people of the land went out to the house of Baal, tore it down, his altars, the images. All these things, they break down. The priest anointed officers over the house. Verse 21, Joash was 7 years old when he became king. He reigned in verse 1 of chapter 12, 40 years in Jerusalem. And look at this, verse 2 of chapter 12. Jehoash, or Joash, however, he's the same guy, did right in the sight of the Lord all the days in which Jehoiada the priest instructed him. So as long as he had this mentor figure in his life, he ruled in a godly way. The problem was Jehoiada's going to die, the high priest, and when he dies, that godly influence, that e-break in his life is gone. So he does really, really well. That's his story. The rest of chapter 12, they literally begin to repair the temple. Athaliah, apparently, in her reign, had put Baal worship stuff in the temple. They had not seen to make sure that God was being worshipped in chapter 12 in the temple. Jehoiada and Joash together make repairs in the temple in chapter 12. That's the whole story. They're putting money to it and tithe to it, and they're making sure this gets done. It's a really, really cool story. The problem is, again, he dies, and the influence of this older godly priest in Joash's life is gone, and he turns at the end of his life and doesn't finish well. Okay, so now we're moving through a bunch of kings, but just again, give you guys the lay of the land and what's happening. These next few, that we'll kind of skip rocks through. I don't want to read a ton of them, but I'll give you a summary of their story. And now in chapter 13, verse 1, we get Jehoahaz. He's a king in the north in Israel. He is, again, just a nugget of a story. He's known for his sin. He did evil on the side of the Lord. He really uses God, won't repent. That's kind of his story, unfortunately. So you see a couple more of these kings that come that way. Chapter 14, you got Amaziah. I do want you to know a little bit about him. He is king in Judah. He's a good, He starts good, as a lot of them do, but he's got a fascinating story. If Rehoboam's the biggest idiot in your Bible because he wouldn't relent on the people, this is Solomon's son, and take the pressure off them in terms of what he did, this guy's very similar. He does something that's really odd. It's not mentioned here, but in the same story in 2 Chronicles chapter 25, Chronicles, by the way, chronicles all of Judah's kings. It ignores Israel, okay? So if you want the extended director's cut version of all of Judah's kings, that's Chronicles, okay? So I'm actually going to read from one of the stories, the next king, Amaziah's son, his name is Uzziah, but we'll read a story in Chronicles because it's a little bit more, we get more detail. This guy, he's an idiot because he defeats Edom. So this king comes in, he defeats Edom to the south, and then all of a sudden decides, I'm going to worship all their gods. And you're like, dude, you just defeated a country, your God against their God, and then you decide to abandon Yahweh and worship the gods of the nation that you just defeated. Like, dumb, right? And he's told so by a prophet, like, dude, or by God, literally, why did you do this? You're just an idiot. So, and then he decides to pick a fight, this is even funnier, with... After he defeats Edom, he's feeling really prideful. So then he's going to go to Israel in the north and pick a fight. Look at chapter 14, verse 8. It says, then Amaziah sent messengers to Jehoash, the son of Jehoahaz, the son of Jehu, the king of Israel. So the king in Judah sends messengers or a message to the king in Israel and says, come, let us face each other.
Jehu?
No, the son of Jehu. Okay, Jehu's dead. Jehoash is his name. This is the guy that's on the throne right now, okay? This is the king that started well but ends bad when the priest dies. And this is a fascinating commentary that he gives him in verse 9. It's just worth reading. It's such a great saying. Chapter 14, verse 9. Someone read that. This is the response when this guy's trying to pick a fight.
And Jehoash, king of Israel, sent word to Amaziah, king of Judah. A thistle on Lebanon sent to a cedar of Lebanon, saying, give your daughter to my son for a wife, and a wild beast of Lebanon passed by and trampled down the thistle.
So it's saying this weak thing is demanding something from a much stronger thing, a thorn bush to a cedar tree. And the cedar tree's like, really? Like, who do you think you are? And then he explains what he means in verse 10. You have indeed defeated Edom, the king of Israel says to the king of Judah. Good for you. And your heart has become proud. Like, you're a little bit too big for your britches right now. And then he says, enjoy your glory and stay home. Meaning, good for you. Throw yourself a party because you defeated Edom, but you don't want none of this. Stay home. Don't come into Israel and pick a fight with me because I will spank you. And sure enough, verse 11, Amaziah would not listen. So he's told, you don't want any of this. And Amaziah says, oh, yes, I do. And Jehoash, the king in the north, says, you don't. And sure enough, he says, okay. And he picks a fight in verse 13. The king of Israel spanks him just like he said he would. And in verse 14, he took all the gold and silver and all the utensils which were found in the house of the Lord in Jerusalem and in the treasuries of the king's house, and he brought them into Samaria. I told you not to pick a fight with me. You picked a fight with me. I'm going to come into Jerusalem. I'm going to take all your stuff, and then I'm going to take it home. Thank you very much.
The wall of Jerusalem is broken down?
Partly.
Does that have any significance
in? Yeah, this is the wall around Jerusalem that's used for protection. It's the one wall that's around the temple. We're going to see it completely destroyed here in a couple more chapters. But yes, that is coming. So... good note. It's not completely done yet, but it's the beginning of the end is upon us.
When does the exile start?
At the end of 2 Kings, I'll show you. Almost there, okay? Chapter 15 tells the story of Uzziah, and he is one king I want you guys to know about. He's one of my favorites because he's got such a good story. Turn real quick to 2 Chronicles, chapter 26. This is the exact same story. We just get more details. So you'll notice in 2 Kings 15, we get 7 verses on this guy, and I'm going to give you a little bit more. And he's a great story that I want you guys to see. So 2 Chronicles 26, so two books over. And I want you to see how this guy starts. Ahaziah is his dad, the guy that we just read about who picked a fight and got spanked and then worshipped Edom's gods after defeating Edom. Okay, so 2 Chronicles 26, verse 1. Listen to this. All the people of Judah took Uzziah, who was 16 years old, and made him king in place of his father, Amaziah. He built Eloth, restored it to Judah after the king slept with his father, so he's rebuilding cities. He's 16 years old when he becomes king, and he reigns, in verse 3, for 52 years in Jerusalem. 2 Kings gives us 7 verses on him, and Chronicles gives us 23. Okay? 52 years he reigns. Second only to Manasseh, who we haven't read about, in all the kings. All 39 kings in the north and the south, he has the second longest reign of anybody, and we get a chapter on him, and here's why. Verse 4, Jordan, pick up there.
Did right in the sight of the Lord according to all that his father Amaziah had done.
Okay, so his dad started well, and then he turns. Uzziah's the same way, he starts well, keep going.
He continued to seek God in the days of Zechariah, who had understanding through the vision of God. And as long as he sought the Lord, God prospered.
So, we see that theme, right? He follows God, God blesses him. And through the vast majority of this king's reign, I would say probably 80%, 90%, 95%, the guy's as good as gold. He looks like a Josiah, a Hezekiah, a godly king through and through, okay? 6 through 15 is all of his accomplishments. It's insane. He waged war against the Philistines. He built cities in the area of Ashdod among the Philistines. So he's putting the pagan people to work. He's battling against them. Verse 7, God helped him against the Philistines. The Ammonites, in verse 8, gave tribute to Uzziah. His fame extended to the border of Egypt. The Egyptian kings hear about this guy. He becomes famous. Verse 9, Uzziah built towers in Jerusalem. What is this? At the corner gate, at the valley gate, at the corners of the buttresses, and fortified them. He built towers in the wilderness. He hewed cisterns. Many people believe... in verse 9, these are catapults that he builds on the corners of towers, like that he invented or at least put to use for the first time, catapults in warfare. So he's ingenious, right? Verse 10, he has much livestock. He's solving drought issues. He's got cisterns. I mean, he's taking care of his people. Verse 11, he's got an army ready for battle. Under his direction, verse 13, is an army of 307,000 people. I mean, he's got a big army. Verse 15 here, you see it even more. Read that last thing that's mentioned in his accomplishments.
In Jerusalem, he made engines of war invented by skillful men to be on the towers and on the corners for the purpose of shooting arrows and great stones. Hence his fame spread afar.
All right, pause right there. So this guy is a mate, right? He invents stuff. He's a great king. And again, 52 years he reigns until...
Hence his fame spread afar, for he was marvelously helped until he was strong.
Until he was strong. He got way too full of himself, realized all the things that he had done, and got a little bit too big for his britches, and pride crept in at the end of his life. And in verse 16, watch what happens. Jimmy, keep going.
He became strong. His heart was so proud that he acted corruptly. And he was unfaithful to the Lord his God. For he entered the temple of the Lord to burn incense on the altar.
So what does he do?
Doesn't he use a priest?
He said, I'm king and priest. I can do whatever I want, right? And God says, no, you can't. We have one of those guys. His name is Jesus, and you're not him. So he's coming, but you're not that guy. Then Azariah the priest entered after him with 80 priests of the Lord and said, bro, bad idea. Is it not for you, Uzziah? It is not for you, Uzziah, to burn incense to the Lord, but for the priests, the sons of Aaron, who are consecrated to burn incense. Get out of the sanctuary, for you have been unfaithful and will have no honor from the Lord God. He gets a warning from the high priest and 80 JV Levite priests, right? Get out while you still have a moment. Don't do this. God will have no honor in this. And he says, no. basically. I'm not leaving. Keep reading to 19, Jordan.
But Uzziah, with the censer in his hand for burning incense, was enraged. And while he was enraged with the priest, the leprosy broke out on his forehead before the priests in the house of the Lord beside the altar of incense.
So he literally has that, like Nadab and Abihu, that shovel in his hand for burning incense, and he's taking from the altar outside into now the inner portion of the temple this incense offering. And he's acting the role of a priest. Now, what was hammered, by the way, all over the outside of the altar from the last time we had some priests that didn't do their duties correctly? Do you guys remember that from Numbers 8 through 10? They took the censers, the bronze censers, from Nadab and Abihu and those priests and hammered them on the outside of the altar as a reminder to anybody that saw that altar of that story. These doofuses gave the wrong type of offering to God as priests, and God was displeased and brought fire from heaven, like one, it's like the second verse into the story, and killed them immediately. So he should have, it was like an audio visual. It's an Ebenezer of remembrance, and he doesn't, in his own foolishness, remember it, or he thinks so much of himself that it doesn't matter. So God strikes him with leprosy. Now, I've told you guys a little bit about leprosy, but I think this specific case is fascinating. So leprosy is a disease where you lose the ability to feel physically, okay? The things that lepers want the most is the ability to feel again, right? And it starts in your fingertips, your toes, all the extremities of your body, ears, your nose. Those are the things that become white and begin to flake, and you lose sensitivity in first, and they ultimately die. It's just necrosis of your body. So this guy is given a physical disease that's representative of a spiritual disease, which he has. Why would God give this guy leprosy? What's happened internally in him? He's prideful. He's lost the ability to feel spiritually, right? Because he's insensitive and can't feel what God wants. God gives him an audio visual of that. And literally, as he's in the act of burning incense, God strikes him with leprosy. Ahaziah, the chief priest, in verse 20, and all the priests looked at him, and behold, he was leprous on his forehead, and they hurried him out of there. And he himself also hastened to get out because the Lord had smitten him. 30 seconds ago, you couldn't drag this guy out with 81 priests, and now he is running on his own volition out of the sanctuary, right? And here's his tombstone. 21, King Uzziah was a leper to the day of his death. He lived in a separate house, being a leper. He was cut off from the house of the Lord, and Jotham, his son, was over the king's house and judged the people of the land. The rest of the acts of Uzziah, from first to last, from Isaiah the prophet, is written. Verse 23, Uzziah slept with his fathers. They buried him in a field that belonged to the king, and they said in verse 23, he is a leper. Uzziah lived from here to here, and on his tombstone, he is a leper. That's how he ends, right? When I teach this story in other contexts, what lesson would you draw? If you were to take a 30,000 foot view of this guy and teach about one thing in his life, what would be your, as we call it in teaching team, your C note? Alex, what you got?
What good is it to gain the whole world and lose your soul?
That's a good one. Yeah. I teach it from the perspective of it doesn't matter how you start. Yeah. Nobody cares. He reigned for 50 years, 51 years, and was gold. And he makes one stupid, epically stupid decision at the end of his life, and you guys have never heard of this guy. Have any of you heard of Uzziah before this morning?
He's in a Christian rap song. But they're talking about it in this context. He didn't finish.
Yeah. Remember that. Nobody cares how you start. Nobody. It only matters how you finish. Now, that's not to say that starting well is not important, because it is. But you've got to push through to the tape at the end. This race that we live is not a sprint. It's a marathon, right? This guy is not remembered by any of us because he blew it at the end of his life. He got hard-hearted. He got prideful. He thought too much of himself. And he couldn't finish well. And of all these kings, again, the second longest reign, and we don't have a clue who this guy is, because he doesn't matter. He's an asterisk to the 39 kings that we gotta, you know, try to wrap our heads around. Okay.
What Kings does this go to? Kings, is that 14? Is this more inside on that?
2 Kings 15.
2 Kings 15. Yeah. Okay.
Yep. Okay. His name is also, by the way, if you go back to 2 Kings 15, Azariah or Uzziah. He has two different names. Okay, so y'all figure that out. I don't know why they do that, but nonetheless, nobody asked me. Like, the names aren't confusing enough, and then you give them two, and then you give two kings the same name that reign at the same time, right? And then their alternate names are both the same. Like, I don't understand. So anyway, so back to 2 Kings. I just wanted you guys to see the extended version of his story. And again, as I think through, you know, you guys are going to get asked to teach it. FCA or whatever, these are the type of stories that you can mine gold from that no one's ever heard, right? And you can teach some amazing lessons. These are the ones that you want to keep in your back pocket on a 3x5 card that you can pull out at any point and go, I can teach this in 5 minutes. They're gold. So when you're asked to lead a Bible study or teach somewhere or whatever it may be, these are just fun life stories to be able to communicate because they're great and they all... they affect us, and we all wrestle with the same thing. So finish well. Hashtag Uzziah. All right. So back to 2 Kings 15. That's this guy's reign. And we won't mention some of these other ones. If you guys just look on the right-hand side of your chart, we're going to whittle through some more of these kings. And by the time we get to chapter 17, we're going to see now the downfall of the northern kingdom. Okay, Israel is going to be at the end of their reign, and Assyria is about to come in and wreck shop in their life, okay? If you look in, let's see, chapter 16 real quick, let's cover a bit of that. You've got King Ahaz in Judah, who's the current king. The king of Assyria is mentioned in chapter 16, verse 10. This guy, this is brilliant, brilliantly stupid. The king of Judah, who is Ahaz at the time, in verse 10, goes to Damascus, and he visits this pagan king, and he sees the altar that this pagan king worships at, and he says, you know what? Your altar is better than the altar I have in Jerusalem. Let's make an altar just like yours in the temple, and we'll have two altars. So Ahaz, the king of Judah, 2 Kings chapter 16, builds a second altar. And this chapter 16 is basically his story of his stupid, right? And he basically says, one altar is for the Lord and his work, and the other altar that I built, which is better and more important next to it, is for me to practice divination in the house of God, right? And he borrowed this. I mean, you talk about syncretism at its finest, right? Let's take a little of God, let's take a little bit of what we see from the pagan lands, let's put them all in the temple together, we'll worship God, and we will worship other gods at the same time. And it's just, it's a jacked up situation, okay? So, that's the current, like, that's what's happening in the south. Now, meanwhile, chapter 17, in the north, here is where their line ends, okay? The last king in the north is a guy by the name of Hoshea, okay? Hezekiah is going to be the king in the south. I just want you guys to realize this. And he's got a front row seat to everything we're about to see. Okay? So as the northern kingdom in Israel gets destroyed, he is watching all this happen. Okay? So just keep that in mind. Hezekiah is a godly king for the most part. He's a doofus, but he's a good king. In chapter 17 now, we're going to see Assyria, the current world superpower, come in and take the north. Okay? Chapter 17, verse 6. In the ninth year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria captured Samaria and carried away all of Israel into exile into Assyria and settled them in Hala and Habor. The river goes on in the cities of the Medes. So I'll tell you a little bit more about Israel's experience in Assyria and how Assyria operates and what they do to their captives. It's pretty fascinating. We'll get a picture of it in. So Assyria comes in and they take the people out of the land and they basically scatter them all over their country. Okay, they had defeated other countries. So anywhere where they had reign, which at this point Assyria was really big, they're just throwing and dispersing the people everywhere. And I'll show you why here in a bit. Okay, now We're going to see in verses 7 and following why God did this and why God allows the northern kingdom to come to an end after 19 ungodly kings. Somebody pick up in 17:7 and let's watch what's going on.
Now this came about because the sons of Israel had sinned against the Lord their God, who had brought them up from the land of Egypt from under the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and they had feared other gods.
Okay, so they are obviously idolatrous. They're in the midst of syncretism. Verse 9, they built for themselves high places in their towns, from the watchtower to fortified cities. Verse 10, they set for themselves sacred pillars and asherim on every hill, under every green tree. Everywhere you look, there was a place to worship a false deity in Israel. Everywhere. Verse 12, they served idols. Verse 13, the Lord warned Israel and Judah throughout all the prophets and every seer, saying, turn from your evil ways. Verse 14, however, they did not listen. They stiffened their neck like their fathers who would not believe the Lord their God. Verse 15, they rejected his statutes, his covenant, which they had made with their fathers, and the warnings which they had warned them. God is gracious. He is patient. He warns them. He sends prophets. By the way, Isaiah, Jeremiah, these big name prophets that we know about, they are more probably to Judah than the south. But God is sending people to say, stop with the stupid and worship me. And they will not do it. Joe, pick up there in verse 16.
They forsook all the commandments of the Lord their God and made for themselves a molten image, even two calves, and made Asherim and worshiped all the hosts of the heaven and served Baal.
Like, we've seen all this before, but here's what we haven't seen. Keep reading 17.
Then they made their sons and daughters pass through the fire and practiced divination and enchantments and sold themselves to the evil in the sight of the Lord, provoking him.
What does it mean that they made their sons and daughters pass through the fire? Yeah. Child sacrifice is rampant in Israel. They're worshiping Chemosh and Molech. We're going to see one of the gods is called, what's his name? Right hand side of my page, just right over here. Topheth, which is basically another name for Molech. We'll see him in a little bit. But they are, they've embraced idolatry to the place where there's no more idolatry to embrace. You've embraced it all 110%.
So I see, like, the temptation to follow our idols today, but I'm not, like, I don't get what would tempt them to serve.
I think we see a hint of it in, what battle was that? Where God wins the battle, it may have been with Ahab, in the mountains, mm-hmm. And the pagan army says, their God is a God of the mountains. Our God is a God of the valleys. If we come to the valleys and wage war, our God can defeat their God. So it's a sense of, well, this isn't your land. You guys are imports. You came from Egypt. It used to be, but we've lived here for 400 years. So if you want to know how to grow crops, you worship the God of the crops. Do you want to eat? Great. Then you need to worship this God. Do you like rain? Ah, okay. Baal and Ashtoreth bring rain. So it was practical. So, as odd as that sounds to us with a scientific mind and understanding evaporation and condensation, and you're like, no, it's not actually where rain comes from. That's how they worship. So it was a very practical, that was the idea.
Thought popped in my head a little earlier as you guys were going through all of the different, worship this God and worship this God. The thought of Revelation and how we turn from, like, we have so many different practices, and even now and today, like, we want to be harmonious with, you know, these bumper stickers that say coexist, and you have, like, all these religion signs,
mm-hmm.
And even now, we're, like, we have so much of the split of the church of, like, well, do we allow homosexuals, do we not, what's your opinion, not the scripture, but what's your opinion on this?
Mm-hmm.
And so fast forward to Revelation, where you have just this culture who has basically said, screw you, God, we're going to do things the way we like to do things. I think this is similar in the culture of what's happened
mm-hmm.
here. Like, it's literally been hundreds of years.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the United States even hasn't been established
right.
for hundreds of years.
Right.
So, like, you have this
right.
culture that has literally been doing this for hundreds and hundreds of years,
mm-hmm.
they have forgotten about God. And, you know, even with America, like, it was initially established with this idea of Christianity that we've forgotten God.
Totally.
And we're moving away and moving away and further away and saying, oh, I got this. I can do this.
Yeah. Think about that. So the kingdom split in 931 B.C., okay, underneath Rehoboam and Jeroboam, underneath Solomon. And the end of this line is going to happen in 722 B.C. Okay, so we're talking about 200 years of history that we just read through in these generations. And as you look at where we're at as a society, as you look at the mirror image of our society that's just further in front of us, that's called Europe, where they've abandoned everything. Where a big church is like 30 people because they're so secular. Gang, we're dinosaurs. We're old. Our views are seen as antiquated and behind and dumb. And what's seen as progress is, man, gay marriage and kill babies. And these are the things that a progressive, advancing society should adopt and think through, right? There's certainly technological, you know, advances that we should all embrace and say, yeah, that's fine and good. Like, who doesn't like solar and electric cars and I don't know, whatever. But morally, there's a divide there, and people see us as completely irrelevant, and that's what's happening. The church is absolutely irrelevant in Europe, the people of God. So we're seeing a foreshadowing of what we're going to look like if God does not choose to change. So anyway, it's frightening, but here's 200 years of history, and again, yeah, that's the temptation. Worship the advanced gods of the land who bring these things, you know, and that's where they're at. So anyway, let's get back to the text. We need to get some work done. No, it's good, but that's the reality. I had a Tommy Nelson, our pastor in at Denton Bible, said, man, if I had one text to teach, if they ever invite me to teach in Congress, he's like, I'm teaching 2 Kings 17, and just the downfall of a society and what they did and who they worshiped and how they just flat out abandoned God. And as a result, God said, I'm going to abandon you. I mean, the words that he says here are frightening.
It's just kind of crazy how a foreign country comes into apparently the land of God, and every place has a worship for foreign gods. And you're like, hey, this is a lot like back home.
Doesn't that sound familiar?
What's the difference?
Yeah. Let's make sure that everybody's comfortable in our land, can worship the gods they want. Let's not call everybody or anybody extreme. You know, let's make sure that they all feel comfortable worshiping whatever god they choose. But the people of the land that have been worshiping a god that the nation was created on are ostracized and made fun. It's fascinating. So, tolerance. Verse 20 of chapter 17. The Lord rejected all the descendants of Israel and afflicted them and gave them into the hands of plunderers until he had cast them out of his sight. God takes his hand off the steering wheel and says, Assyria, come on in. You're going to be my stick. The sons of Israel, verse 22, walked in the sins of Jeroboam, which they did. They did not depart from him. Verse 23, so Israel was carried away into exile from their own land to Assyria to this day. God allows them to be carried away. Okay. Now, a little bit about how Assyria works. Watch this. 24. The king of Assyria brought men from Babylon, from all these other places, and he settles them in the cities of Samaria in place of the sons of Israel. So he takes all but the poorest people of the land, and you see in, it's mentioned somewhere in the text, he leaves the poor of the land there, distributes all the Israelites all over Assyria, takes Assyrians and Babylonians and every other country that they've conquered and brings them into Israel, but not pure Assyrians, like a mixed bag of people, and then he puts some of the Israelites with them. Why? What's Assyria doing?
Assimilating.
You're going to become the Borg. We're going to make a new race out of you. We're going to strip away your identity, your gods, your culture, your art, your history, and you are going to become us. So we're going to take every nation that we've conquered, we're going to put them all in a big pot, and we're going to stir it up together, and this is going to be the new Assyria. Egyptians, Babylonians, Assyrians, Israelites, whatever country we've defeated, and we're going to teach you what we want you to know. It's Star Trek and the assimilation into the Borg, literally, okay? That's their policy. They are awful. You do not want to be captured by Assyria. They don't like you. They cut your heads off. They're horrible. The Ninevites, and why Jonah didn't want to go to Nineveh is because the way that the Ninevites treated their captives, they were awful. And if you don't like it, they don't care. They were horrible in the way that they would assimilate people. But that was their idea. If we can strip away from you everything that is of you, then you have no loyalty to anybody, right? You don't remember anything. We can just weed that out through generations, and then you become loyal to us because we feed you, we clothe you, and whatever. That is their deportation strategy, okay? America is going to be a little bit more like Babylon, actually, and I'll show you what they look like, okay? That's Assyria, okay? They're awful. Assyria is probably a little bit more like ISIS. We're going to come in, we're going to take over, and you're going to become us, period. And if you don't like it, we're going to stick you in a cage and set you on fire. Assyria did all this stuff, by the way. All this stuff before ISIS or anybody else invented it. They're awful. Okay? Horrible, horrible, horrible.
Is it all interesting that the country of Syria is still in existence today, mm-hmm. which is all the same people?
Yep. Yep. Iran, Iraq, Syria, all those places are still, that's where the Assyrians set up shop. Okay? There is a pretty funny story going on in here. God is a God of the land. He cares about the land. He kicked all his people out of the land. So they get sent in, the Assyrians and all these other mixed bag of people get sent in. So it came about in verse 25 that they did not fear the Lord. Therefore, the Lord sent lions among them and killed some of them. So they don't worship the God of the land in God's land. So God sends lions to kill the people that come in. Like, I don't need you Israelites to do my job for me. Like, if you're not going to stand up for me, I can stand up for myself. I'll send in lions. So verse 26, the people living there sent word to the king saying, hey, the nations whom you have carried away into exile into the cities of Samaria do not know the customs of the God of the land. You put us in this new land and we all got eaten by lions. And we got eaten by lions because we don't know what the God of this land wants. And you just kicked all the people out that had any knowledge of the land. So they didn't kill them and they did not know the custom of the God of the land. So they said in verse 27, take one of the priests whom you carried away into exile and let him go and live there, back in the land, in Israel. And let him teach the custom of the God of the land. So God orchestrates that the king of Assyria dictates that they take a priest from Israel, bring him back into Israel, and teach all the pagans in the land about the God of Israel. Like, that's what God wanted from the beginning, right? For the people to do that, but God can do it himself. So it's funny. Now, they don't worship God. God's one of their mantles, right, of a gazillion gods that they worship. So it doesn't get any better. Verse 33, they feared the Lord and serve their own gods. So, okay, good. They know about this God now, but it's one of many that they worship. So, anyway, that's chapter 17. End of the last verse of chapter 17, verse 41. While these nations feared the Lord, they also served their idols, their children likewise, and their grandchildren, and their fathers did so to this day. As we think about the area specifically that Assyria populated, it was Samaria. Okay, so you talk about the Samaritans today. These are the people that live there. Okay, this mongrel race that the Jews cannot stand because they're not Jews, they're not Assyrians, they're this mixed bag, they're mutts. And Jews take offense to the fact that they would want to worship the God of the Bible. In Jesus' day, that is why there's so much tension, because this is how that story went down. And they were syncretistic. And in some regard, the Jewish people are fighting for, we're fighting for a sense of we worship God and God alone, and you worship a pantheon of gods, and you make one of them the same or sound the same as our God, and they won't stand for that, okay? So, there you go. The north is gone. 721, 722 BC, I would know that date if I were you, okay? The north goes down first. Now, again, in the south, chapter 18, Hezekiah has literally a box seat, and he's watching this fight go on, and Assyrians come in and wreck shop. It's on this chart. It's on a bunch of charts. 722 BC, okay? So, all written down for you, okay? Now, Hezekiah, we're going now back to Judah in the south, is a good king. He reigns 25 years. He was 25 years old when he becomes king. How long does he reign? 29 years. He does some great stuff, removed high places. In verse 4, the Bible mentions that there's no king like him among the kings of Judah. He does a really, really good job. The Lord was with him. He rebelled against the king of Assyria and did not serve him. So after the king of Assyria came in and wrecked shop up north, obviously he's going to come down and try to take Judah as well. God doesn't allow it to happen, and we'll see how that story unfolds in chapter 18 and 19. Okay? Yeah, Jimmy.
Verse 4, he also broke to pieces the bronze serpent that Moses had made.
You guys remember way back in Numbers, I think it's 21, that healing stick? Apparently it had turned from a memorial of something that Moses had done to a idol that was to be worshipped. Come on. So, yeah. So he is intentionally breaking down anything that is leading the people to a false worship. Okay. And that thing was right turns into evil, right? It's the same that you see today. Like, you walk into the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and you watch people that are worshiping a stone that they may have laid Jesus on, or selling, you know, rags that have touched that stone on eBay. You know, someone went there and
germs are on that stone.
Yeah, people are licking it and crying on it. It's fascinating. But just
selling pieces of the cross.
Yeah, that's it, right? You can go in there and touch the cross, right? You can touch the rock where it was. I put my hand on it, you know. But there's people literally that are, this is like their bucket list item in their life, and they're losing, I mean, they're weeping uncontrollably because they got to touch the rock that may have held the cross in place that where Jesus hung. And they're worshiping the location and not the... It is powerful. It was powerful to watch. It was weird. I touched the rock. You guys want to touch my hand? $5 a piece. This hand right here touched it. $5 a pop. So, yeah. Yeah. I hear 5. Do I hear 20? Anyway, so Hezekiah is now going to come in, and he's going to do some great things. Look at verse 13. Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, came up against all the cities of Judah. Okay, Sennacherib comes in. He's the king of Assyria. And he says, hey, I just cleared out the north. Hezekiah, now I'm coming for you. I'm going to take Judah as well. Hezekiah said to the king of Assyria at Lachish, you guys remember the four gateway cities to Israel? Gezer, Bet-Shemesh, Azekah, Lachish. The idea is that Assyria has come in and defeated every one of those cities, and now he's in Lachish, the last of the gateway cities, and he's going to come east into Jerusalem and take Jerusalem. So literally, Judah is on the verge of falling to Assyria. And now Hezekiah reaches out to the king of Assyria, Sennacherib, and says, dude, what do you want? I have done wrong. Withdraw from me, Hezekiah says. Anything you impose on me, I'll give you whatever you want. And king of Assyria says, sign a check and don't fill out the number. I'll go ahead and do that myself. He asks for 300 talents of silver in verse 14 and 30 talents of gold. I got a note in my Bible, about 360,000 ounces or 11 tons. So this isn't Solomon big, but it is big nonetheless. 11 tons of gold 11 tons of silver and 1 ton of gold. So Hezekiah, in order to find that much stuff, that much gold and silver, look at verse 16. This is what he does to supply that need for Assyria to get off his back.
At that time, Hezekiah stripped the gold from the doors of the temple of the Lord, and from the doorposts of Hezekiah, the king of Judah, had overlaid and gave it to the king of Assyria.
So he literally has to strip the temple of its gold and silver, of what's remaining, and send it FedEx to the king of Assyria and say, here's a ton of what you wanted, and 11 tons of silver. So then the king of Assyria says, no, you know what? Check that. I'm going to take all your stuff, and I changed my mind. I'm coming in anyway. And in verses 17 and following, this is possibly some of the best smack talk in your Bible. Okay, the king of Assyria basically sends delegates to come punk Hezekiah and to punk the people. And they roll through their history. So they show up into town and basically say, Assyria is coming, and you need to fear. And if you think that your God can save you or that Hezekiah can save you, he can't. It's beautiful. They say in verse 29, and they smack talk all the way up to this. It's some beautiful stuff to read. Do not let Hezekiah deceive you, for he will not be able to deliver you from my hand. So this is the delegate speaking on behalf of the king of Assyria, saying, hey, people of the land, don't listen to your king. He's going to tell you that he can protect you from me. He can't. We're coming. And then he walks through his resume. Do not let Hezekiah make you trust in the Lord, saying, the Lord will surely deliver us, and this city shall not be given to the king of Assyria. He's going to give you some pep talk in the locker room saying that we can win. And the king of Assyria is saying, you can't. You simply cannot win. Do not listen, verse 31, to the king, Hezekiah. And then he says, in verse 32, do not listen to Hezekiah when he misleads you, saying, the Lord will deliver us. God will show up and deliver us. And then they say this in verse 33. This is great. Has any one of the gods of the nations delivered his land from the hand of the king of Syria? Hey, we just defeated Babylon, by the way, who's the big king on the block at this point. We won that battle. Did their gods show up against me and defeat and rescue them? No. We defeated Egypt. Did the Egyptians' gods show up and beat us, the king of Assyria is saying? No. Nor is your God going to be able to do that. So it's some hilarious smack talk. And they realize what Hezekiah is going to try to do to strengthen his people, and they just punk him. So the whole chapter up through 19 is these three delegates saying, don't listen to your king. You're as good as dead in our hands. So it's funny. However, God doesn't think it's funny. Hezekiah chapter 19, verse 1, hears all this, and he doesn't know anything else to do, so he literally cries and goes into the house of the Lord and is like, Lord, what do we do? Yeah.
Back in chapter 18, I like how they're basically saying, don't listen to your king, but verse 36, it says, but the people didn't answer because their king said, don't answer.
Yeah. They're trying to hold on to hope, and God's going to show up. It's pretty cool. Basically, Hezekiah cries out to the Lord, which is great, and Isaiah is ministering to him, the prophet Isaiah. And he says in verse 6, thus says the Lord, do not be afraid because of the words that you have heard, which the servants of the king of Syria have blasphemed me. Verse 7, he shall hear a rumor and return to his own land. I will make him fall by the sword in his own hand. The king of Assyria is going to die by a sword in his own hand. Not his own, literally, but his son's hand. We'll find out through extra-biblical sources. But God says, this guy is talking so much trash, I have to show up. And Isaiah comes to comfort, basically, Hezekiah and tell him that, man, it's going to end well. Hezekiah, verse 15, prays before the Lord, begs God in 19, O Lord, I pray, deliver us from his hand, and all the kingdoms of the earth may know that you alone are Lord your God. So Hezekiah is a godly dude. He's saying to God, your glory, God's at stake. We know we're dead. There's nothing we can do. If you don't show up, God, we're done. And it's your reputation at stake. So you look at this guy and go, man, I like him. This is a good dude, right? Fast forward now to chapter 19, verse 32. Therefore, the Lord, concerning the king of Assyria, says to Hezekiah, he shall not come to this city or shoot an arrow there. He's not even going to step foot in Jerusalem. They're in Lachish right now, right? Just miles west of Jerusalem. Verse 32, chapter 19. Neither shall he come before it with a shield or throw a mound up against it. He's not going to build a siege ramp. He's not going to have a sword in his hand. By the way he came, he's going to leave. And he's going to go back to his own city. For verse 34, I will defend this city and save it for my own sake and for my servant David's sake. I mean, again, David's still showing up in the text. Now, we get one verse on how God does this. Read verse 35.
In that night, the angel of the Lord went out and struck down 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians. Oh, and when the people rose early in the morning, behold, they were all these dead bodies.
Behold, they were all dead. God shows up and kills 185,000 people. That's like half the population of Fresno. That'd have been like 250, but you get the idea.
That's just one dude?
The angel of the Lord.
One angel.
Oh, the angel of the Lord. One dude. The angel of the Lord.
That must
kills
be
them all.
Awesome action movie.
So Sennacherib walks out of his tent, right, the next morning, Folgers in hand, drinking coffee, and looks around, and there's no movement. Every warrior is dead. They're in Lachish, and they're literally camping out, and they're getting ready to go into Jerusalem, and God kills them by the hand of the angel of the Lord.
I heard a very powerful message one time where someone said, when we're standing in the Garden of Gethsemane, and someone is like, Christ could have called a host of angels to have come rescued him, mm-hmm. recognizing and then using this verse to say, one of those angels can do this much damage, mm-hmm. and there's a host mm-hmm. of them. Imagine, they could have leveled the globe 10 times over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. Totally. It's true. It's Kyle?
Who's saying that command that God gave out? Is it just like, here's what the Lord said?
Who's saying the command? That came from Isaiah. Isaiah is the prophet that God uses to speak to Hezekiah, saying, dude, don't worry about it. God's got this.
So is all of the book of Isaiah within this time frame?
Yeah, he writes previous to this. He's back in, I want to say like 30 years prior to this, he's ministering. So yeah, it's during this season. He and Jeremiah both are ministering during this time, calling Judah to repentance. So yeah, okay. So crazy. God shows up. Now, their destruction's coming. It's just not coming now. Okay? So it's 720 BC-ish. And God says, no, I'm going to preserve a remnant in the south, in Judah. The northern kingdom's gone. But this is not how this is going to go down. Now, here, excuse me, is the problem with Hezekiah. He's a bit of a doofus. Okay? Chapter 20, verse 1, he gets sick to the point of death. And literally God says to him in verse 1, set your house in order, for you shall die and not live. Write your will, get ready to die, you're going home. And, you know, he's like, okay, all good. Hezekiah, verse 3, wept bitterly. He doesn't want to die, okay? And God says, you know what, dude? Okay, verse 6, I will add 15 years to your life. I'm going to give you a bonus 15 years. I was going to kill you next week and take you home. You want more. You're a godly king. I'll give you 15 years. So, he gives him a bonus 15 years. What are you going to do if you're King Hezekiah? You know you've got 15 years to live. You watch God just defeat Assyria in this miraculous thing. The north is gone because of idolatry and sin and stupidity. What are you going to do as the king of Israel? What would you do with those years? Build up Judah, right? What else?
Retire.
Yeah, maybe. You would hope that this guy would say, you know what? I got 15 years to pour my guts out into these people to rid themselves of idolatry, any false worship, to get these people walking with God so that I can hand the baton to my son, Manasseh?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And instill godliness in the next generation, okay? That's what you would hope he would do, okay? But he doesn't. Verse 12. Babylon, during this time, has become the superpower on the block. They put down Assyria, and we'll see that here later. The king of Babylon sent letters and a present to Hezekiah, for he had heard that he was sick. So the king of Babylon sends Hezekiah a Hallmark card and says, man, we're so sorry that you're sick. Here's some flowers and some chicken noodle soup. Hezekiah listened to them, and then he does this in verse 13. He brings them in and showed them all his treasure house, the silver and the gold and the spices and the precious oil, his armor, his treasuries, his house, his dominion that Hezekiah had shown to them. He literally walks the king of Babylon through and says, here's my credit cards, here's all my gold, here's my social security number, here's all my wealth. You want my passwords to my bank account so you can have those too? He shows him all the stuff that is his. What is he doing? He's bragging about all the stuff that he has. It's like, dude, these are pagans. Like, what are you thinking? And sure enough, Isaiah the prophet, verse 14 says, dude, what have you done? They have come from Babylon. Like, you should have known better. He answers Isaiah in verse 15 and says, they have seen all that is in my house. There is nothing among my treasuries that I have not shown them. I showed them every dollar that I have. And Isaiah says, dude, you're dumb. Verse 17, days are coming. And that is like right now, that all your fathers laid up in store into this day will be carried into Babylon. Nothing shall be left. You are on the brink of everything being carried away into Babylon. These guys are about to come back in and take all of your stuff. They're not your friends, right? Some of your sons, verse 18, shall issue that you shall issue, whom you literally are going to beget, shall be taken away. They shall become officials in the palace of the king of Babylon. Your sons will become eunuchs and serve this pagan king that you just showed all their stuff to. Like, you are an idiot, Hezekiah. And then his answer in verse 19 is mind-boggling. Joe, read that.
Then Hezekiah said to Isaiah, the word of the Lord which you have spoken is good.
What? How is this good? Well, it's good if you're Hezekiah.
For he thought it is not so if there would be peace, truth,
so you're saying all this is coming, but it's not coming now. So there's going to be peace in my day. I don't care about the next generation. I care about me. So how did he spend these 15 bonus years? Investing in himself. Yeah, your sons are going to be eunuchs. They're going to castrate your sons. They're going to go serve a pagan king. All the stuff that you showed the king, King of Babylon's going to take every bit of it. It's like, that's fine. That's good. Because I get to spend it now. I can drive my Lamborghini. I don't care about the next generation. Unbelievable. One of my favorite Brad Bell stories ever. Ever. We were in the midst of a transition with the Cross Church. We had been there for years as the evening service. The Cross Church owned this church. They'd been through several pastors. Their pastor that was currently there was great friends with the folks at the Well and saw their congregation kind of getting older. And there was no next generation. They were all like 60 plus for the most part. And it was very clearly a dying church. They had land. We needed property. And they had some really, really good people in their body that are still around today. And they had some people that were just grumblers and complainers. I mean, constantly. Everything was a problem. Everything was wrong. And this church became like a health club. It was there to minister to them and all of their needs. And Sam Freshwater, the pastor of the Cross Church at the time, invited Brad to come speak. He said, you know, just pick a message and you can come speak about whatever you want. And Brad taught this message and said, you guys are Hezekiah. You don't care about the next generation. We have a church that's busting at the seams and needs a place to meet. And all you care about is the color of the carpet and where the organ is and that there would be peace in your day. And I'm like, dude, how did you not get shot after that message? So, and then they said, you know what, you're right. And they gave the Well the facility. So, fascinating. But yeah, it was, I'm like, dude, not for all the money in the world would I have done that. So, I mean, literally. And some of the people were, again, the most godly, amazing folks, and they're still around today and love them. But they had probably three quarters of their congregation was just, unfortunately, grumbling, bitter people about whatever. And that was kind of their MO in life. And they all left and went other places. But the church was dying because of that attitude. It was all about me. So Hezekiah is a great guy, but this is his legacy, right? Unfortunately, he spends the last 15 years of his life investing in himself, and it's just sad. So moving on now. The most evil king in all of Israel that you ever get is Hezekiah's son. He had 15 years to invest in the next generation, and he doesn't. And specifically, you see the results in his son. 21, Manasseh was 12 years old when he became king. He reigns 55 years in Jerusalem, the longest reigning king of all the kings. And he did more evil in the sight of the Lord. And it says in verse 2, the abominations of the nations whom the Lord dispossessed from before the sons of Israel. They literally have to compare this guy to like pagan kings because he's so bad. Like they can't even compare him to Israel kings. He's got so much evil in him. Verse 3, he rebuilt the high places which Hezekiah, his father, had destroyed. He erected altars of Baal, Asherah, that King Ahab worshipped. He builds altars in the house of the Lord to serve all these pagan gods. Verse 5, he built altars for all the hosts of heaven. two courts in the house of the Lord. He made his sons pass through fire, practice divination, witchcraft. He dealt with mediums and spiritists. He did much evil in the sight of the Lord, provoking him to anger. Yeah, I guess he did, right? To the degree that Hezekiah worshipped the Lord, this guy went the complete opposite direction. I mean, you see a dude with that was not poured into by his dad, and was not brought up in the right way. This guy is awful, and unfortunately, takes evil to a whole new degree. We haven't seen specifically kings mentioned in doing this, passing through fire, worshiping Molech and Chemosh and the like. So he is horribly awful. Worships again 55 years rather, and does that. And says, verse 11, God says, because Manasseh, king of Judah, has done these abominations, having done wickedly more than the Amorites did who were before them. Like, I literally have to compare you to the Amorites because you're so bad. Like, you've done more evil than the Amorites. Then that's the measuring stick that I have to use against you. Verse 14, I will abandon the remnant of my inheritance and deliver them into the hand of their enemies. God says, I'm done. My fuse is long, but you just reached the end of it. I'm done. I'm going to hand you over to Babylon. And sure enough, all the kings moving forward from here are going to be kings that are now in this Babylonian captivity. Okay, so Assyria took the north at the end of Manasseh's reign after that 55-year period in about 609 BC, 612 to 609. Assyria falls to Babylon. Babylon comes in, and they are now the new superpower, and they're going to take all of Assyria's land and say, thank you very much, and then they're going to take Israel. Judah, I should say, specifically. Okay. What's cool about this is it's during Josiah's reign in chapter 22. Josiah is actually a godly king. He's the last godly king that you're going to see on your chart. He's amazing. He is a revivalist. Man, he finds the law. He finds the word of God. He reads it. He's broken as a result of it and realizes, dude, this chump that's been on the throne, Manasseh, now for 55 years has done none of this, and basically says, if we'll just obey what's here, God will bless us. So even knowing that this basically prophecy of God's coming and that destruction and doom are imminent, Josiah chooses to walk with God. He's amazing. Praise, chapter 22 is all of his story. His heart is tender towards God. Amazing dude. Chapter 23 is about basically him reinforcing the Mosaic covenant. They enter back into a covenant with God where he literally goes through a proper formulation of this covenant. They abandon all these false gods. In the rest of chapter 23, he does something that's absolutely nuts. Look at 23 verse 21. This is crazy to think about how evil the nations have been in this time. 23:21. Yeah.
Then the king commanded all the people, saying, celebrate the Passover to the Lord your God, as it is written in this book of the covenant. Surely such a Passover had not been celebrated from the days of the judges who judged Israel, nor in all the days of the kings of Israel and of all the kings of Judah.
Are you kidding me? They have not celebrated Passover since Judges. I mean, we're at the end of this whole, this is insane. And we're talking thousands. Is it thousands? Judges was 900. It's not quite 1,000. Yeah, but holy cow. Judges is around 1,000 BC. Period before that, yeah. So this is insane. This is how evil they've been, right? All these things that, like, so much of our Pentateuch, our Torah is about the institution of all this stuff and how serious God takes it. He's the first king that says, maybe we should do what's written in here. Like, what do y'all think about that? And they do it.
At what point did they're like, we're going to skip Passover as obviously Jewish people? Like, that's what you think Jewish people, you think Passover.
Mm-hmm.
At what point we're going to just disregard our heritage?
I think it had to do more of, it's just that slippery slope into idolatry and what happened. They're worshiping false gods, and their heritage is so intermingled with everything else, they just forget. And when one generation compromises a little, the next generation, it's just so much easier. Then it's forgotten. Like, Josiah had to read the law and go, oh gosh, this is what we're supposed to be doing. Like, literally, he finds the scroll, like, buried in a closet somewhere, and it's like, did anybody know we had this? Holy cow, it's the Bible. Literally, he's the first king forever who's read it. You know, and you get the idea that Hezekiah had, but it's just, it's fascinating. So, yeah, it's a scary deal when you compromise a little bit, and a generation later, it's been said where there's mist in the pulpit, there's fog in the pews. If you're unclear from up front just a little bit about what God requires, and there's just a mist in the pulpit or in the pews, that becomes a fog. Like, it's thick, it's heavy. So small compromises in the kings led to gigantic compromises in the people. Then you just continue to exacerbate that issue with more and more ungodly kings. So anyway, this guy's amazing. He does amazing stuff. They celebrate the Passover. He breaks down altars. They worship God. Unfortunately, what's coming is still coming. Look at verse 25 of chapter 23. Here's his resume. Before him, there was no king like him who turned to the Lord with all his heart, with all his soul, with all his might, according to the law of Moses, nor did any like him arise after. I mean, that is an amazing resume. So God doesn't relent, unfortunately, on his promise. He says, man, I'm still going to bring havoc. I'm going to delay that because of how godly you've been. But Babylon is going to come in, and they're going to win the day.
What does the name Josiah mean?
No idea. Anybody got a note?
No, I just remember, because I want to name my kid that.
So I've told you guys the story of names in here. Phineas is like one of my heroes, the guy that shish kebabs, those two people in Numbers that are, so funeral that I attended from Brandon and Kimber Jones, they lost their newborn child, and they named him Josiah Phineas. So a guy that recovered the law and made the people walk with God, entered into the covenant, and then middle name Phineas, guy who was zealous for the things of the Lord, and that was kind of their namesake for their kids. So, and it was partly because of our journey through residency and him reading these about these stories of these guys that are just absolutely amazing and zealous for the things of God when being for God is not cool, much like today, name your kid that. So, yeah, it's a great name. Josiah is a great name to give your kids. So I'd still like to meet a Phineas, like, at 20, but, yeah. How did we ruin that name? So, yeah. Anyway, so now, as we move through the rest of this, we got two chapters left. Let me see if I can paint this picture for you. As Kings ends, we are now going to see Egypt is kind of has a season of power. Chapter 23, verse 31, Jehoahaz is a king. Pharaoh Necho comes in verse 33 and imprisons the king of Judah. So it's going poorly. He basically lets him stay there. He gives him a bunch of money, but he has now become a puppet king for Egypt in his own land. And the rest of the pharaohs, or the rest of the kings, are going to be the same. Pharaoh, in verse 34, made Eliakim, the son of Josiah, king in place of Josiah, his father. So it's still an Israelite Hebrew king, but he's a puppet king of basically the Egyptians. And we're going to see again, all these kings are the same way. Chapter 24, in the days of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, he came in and Jehoiakim became his servant for 3 years. This is the beginning of the deportation of the Babylonians. So they're coming in, and three different times they come into Israel or Judah specifically and deport people. Okay, this is 605 BC, not a date that you guys necessarily need to remember, but this is when Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were taken into Babylon. Okay, now, Babylon has a completely different strategy. Okay, if Assyria is assimilate everybody into the Borg, Babylon is, we're going to take the biggest, toughest, strongest, and smartest, and we're going to bring them into Babylon. And we're going to treat you like royalty. We're going to give you everything you want because you're valuable to us. So, if you can prove yourself that you can get, you're strong, you're wise, we'll pour into you and meet all of your needs, and you'll just come to love Babylon because we take such great care of you, right? So they're the kinder, gentler oppressor, if you will. Very different than Assyria. So Babylon took Daniel and his guys, and that's exactly what they were doing, right? Daniel served in the king's court, chose to eat vegetables instead of meat, but he's literally studying underneath the king of Babylon, because the Babylonians saw him as useful, as someone that could be, and that's their strategy, okay? So we're going to take basically great care of you, compared to other oppressors, if you will. So that's how Babylon comes in. So 24 and following, that's their story. They get ransacked a bunch of different times. Look at underneath Jehoiachin, one of the other kings, the king of Babylon, comes in verse 12. Took him captive in the 8th year of his reign. Verse 13, he carried out from there all the treasuries of the house of the Lord, all the stuff that was in it. And he led away, verse 14, into exile all Jerusalem and all the captains and all the mighty men. Okay, so everybody that was of value went with King of Babylon. Everybody that was worthless, he just left them, right? You guys can become workers. Verse 16, men of valor, craftsmen, anybody that was helpful to the king of Babylon, he takes with him. The rest, basically, he lives there, leaves there, rather. Okay?
What's a good strategy to conquer? Because, I mean, if you don't have any leadership or anybody to, you know, understand the economy of the land, then...
So what Babylon does is then they take a governor, they stick him in the land and say, okay, y'all all work the land and just pay us taxes. We don't care. We just want the money and the land. So y'all worship who you want, do whatever you want, just make sure that I get 50% of everything. Fair enough? Okay. Die or do you want that? Okay, we'll take that. That's their strategy. So 25:4, the city was broken down and all the men of war fled. Verse 6, they captured the king, brought him to the king of Babylon, slaughtered the current king of Israel. Verse 9 of chapter 25, they burned the house of the Lord, the king's house, all the houses of Jerusalem, even with great fire. Verse 10, they broke down the walls of Jerusalem. This is 586 BC. The temple's destroyed. The wall around Jerusalem is destroyed. Everything in Jerusalem gets destroyed, and everything is done. Okay, so we talk about our time of exile from here. We're going to move into a 70-year period where Israel is stuck in Babylon and these other nations, and then God is going to allow them to return, and we'll see that on Thursday and Friday underneath Ezra, Nehemiah, and Zerubbabel. Okay, so they are gone. Okay, the place has been repopulated. Israel is now under the control of the Babylonians. There's governors set up from Babylon and such that are puppet kings that pay taxes to the king. Okay, but in terms of this promise that God told Moses, they're all gonna rebel. It all came true, and God kicked them out of the land. Okay, so that's how 2 Kings end on a very depressing note. We'll pick up there on Tuesday or Thursday, rather.
Do you know that saying, "But God"? In this story with the walls, but Nehemiah.
That's right.
So what you're saying is God is who He says He is, and He'll do what He says He'll do.
Pretty much.
The greatest lesson is don't mess with God.
I will send lions to eat you.
Where did Elisha go?
Heaven. Yeah. So he gets taken up into heaven by those chariots of fire. You remember that?
Elisha.
He dies. We just skipped it.
When does he die?
During. I'm trying to remember where. I read it this morning. We just skipped it. But yeah, he dies. Hold on. Where is it? Christ. 13. Yeah, he does his last miracle in 21. Remind me to mention that. We should probably come back. 13:14. Elijah became sick. They weep over him. He dies. Verse 20, Elisha died and they buried him. And then they throw a guy in his grave in 13:21. And the guy revives from the dead. Yeah, so sorry.
Last miracle, he's dead in
one. Yes, 13 ways living and one ways dead. Yeah, so a guy literally comes back to life by touching the dead bones of Elisha. Yeah.
And then Passover, do you know this when, by the time Jesus comes, they're still celebrating it, pretty religiously?
It's like the return.
Culture changes to be, legalistic instead of forgetting God.
Yeah. When Ezra, Nehemiah, and Zerubbabel come back to the land, we never see idolatry again.
Oh.
they come in and they're serious. They're like, we got kicked out of land because of this. We're not doing this again.
Yeah.
So you're going to see. Yeah, I'd say they're pretty zealous even today. You see different issues. You see the remnants of idolatry.
Yeah.
But never again will you see the idolatry that we just read about. That's gone.
Okay.
And these three guys make sure that we're never going to see that. So.
And then I'm like, I'm not stressed about it. But like, when we're not here, when how am I going to know what's
what do you mean?
Like when we get, like if I go to read like Ezekiel.
Right.
Like how will I know when that is?
So just. So just think through that. So there's your whole timeline, beginning to end of the entire Old Testament. Okay, we're right here, right? Ezra, Nehemiah, and you realize all of these things happen.